This is a special episode of the Immunology Podcast, Immunology 2024, Day 1. Hey everyone, this is Dr. Jason Goldsmith and Dr. Brenda Rout. Welcome back to the Immunology Podcast, where we have conversations with immunologists. As you know, today launched the start of Immunology 2024, the annual meeting of the American Associations of Immunologists here in Chicago. And Brenda and myself and the Immunology Podcast team are all attending. Drop by the Immunology Podcast booth, that's booth 708, in the exhibit hall to play some games, win a prize, and find out how you could be featured on an episode of the podcast. Today and every day throughout the meeting, we'll be releasing special episodes discussing our favorite sessions the previous day. So if you weren't able to attend, we've got you covered. We're going to kick things off in just a moment, but before we get to that...
Join Stem Cell at Immunology 2024 for their Mouse T-Cell Workshop at 1 p.m. on Sunday, May 5th, in the Exhibitor Hall Workshop Room 2. This workshop will feature workflow solutions to streamline your mouse T-cell research from isolation to expansion. We also invite you to join Stem Cell's networking social event this Sunday night, starting from 7 p.m. at the Fatpour Tap Works, located at 2206 South Indiana Avenue. See you there. Jason and I will be attending.
All right. Well, you came in yesterday, right, Brenda?
I did. Needed some time for the jet lag to wash off.
I'm remembering that from our last conference and your comments on jet lag.
Yeah. It's tough. It's a 6 hours, you know, they're on the wrong way. So it's hard.
There's a right way.
There is no right way. I guess you have a point. But I plowed through. I made it to the, you know, late evening. So actually, I think I'm correcting it.
There you go.
We'll see tomorrow.
See how much coffee you take every day.
Yeah. Just enough.
Just enough. Yeah, I flew in this morning. So, I also got up very early to be here, but here we are, and we already got the first sessions in. They had about a good 90-minute block of sessions to kick off the afternoon.
Mm-hmm. So why don't you just, you know...
Dive right in,
yeah.
Migrate right to where I'm going. All right, well, I am going to be talking about innate and innate-like cells. See how they migrate was the name of our talk. So these were all 15-minute talks. So if you ask me for in-depth questions, I cannot give in-depth answers here. Because it went a little fast, because, you know, these are the highlight reels. So a couple of really cool talks I saw. One was by Vanessa Borges out of Cedars-Sinai, and she was looking at hyperthermia and its role in protecting against ventilator-induced lung injury. And if you guys remember, we were talking about ARDS, and after you get an infection, the ventilator can often cause damage and exacerbate that ARDS. We talked about that on a podcast recently. And her role was, the formal name of the talk is Hyperthermia Protects Against Ventilator-Induced Lung Injury by Eliminating Gastrumin D Activation.
Oh my God.
And
everywhere.
NET formation. It's Gastrumin D is everywhere you don't want it to be.
Gastrumin D all the way down.
It's my new pet.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah.
Move along, enterocytes. Gastrumin D is coming.
But what if someone studies Gastrumin D in enterocytes?
Well, there's no good off track.
No, yeah. So sorry, I wasn't migrating in the right spot. I got confused. I lost my molecular compass. All right. So neutrophil extracellular trap is a structure neutrophils form, and it's part of their pathology. They didn't go super in detail about this, but what they were showing was that in this LPS plus ventilator injury model, which is what they're using, if you depleted neutrophil depletion with an anti-Ly6 antibody, you're able to limit the injury without affecting IL-1 beta release. So IL-1 beta levels are the same, neutrophils gone, less injury. Okay, so neutrophils, bad actors in lung injury. We kind of know that. Neutrophil extracellular traps, though, if you eliminate IL-1 beta signaling, they go away. So obviously you can't have a trap without a neutrophil, but you'd have a neutrophil without a trap, right? So then they looked at, well, what part of the pathway is important for neutrophils making neutrophil traps? And that was the IL-1 R1 receptor, so that prevents NET formation, neutrophil, but that prevented NET, so if you knock it out, you prevent NET formation, but it doesn't alter neutrophil migration or IL-1 beta release. So that's the proximal receptor for the IL-1 beta activation leading to NET formation. Then they were able to show that hypothermia, so cooling people down, or in this case, mice, inhibits NET formations by controlling macrophage IL-1 beta release, and it does that by macrophage Gastrumin mediation, right? So you have macrophages release IL-1 beta through Gastrumin D cleavage, and that leads to NET formation in vitro. And if you cool them down, that happens less. So that was that paper. There was, real quickly, a couple other highlights. Sherry Eisman from Columbia was looking at natural killer cells and understanding how their development and migration work. And her title of her talk is The Role of CXCR4-CXCL12 in the Development and Migration of Human Natural Killer Cells. So that set, CXCR4-CXCL12, is a known pairing between chemokine receptor for that plays a role in cell proliferation and survival migration. What she showed using tonsil tissue, which is where NK cells are develop a lot, is that the position in the tissue matters for its development. And they did this with some automated cell migration tracking pipeline. They have a new paper coming out in bioarchives with the software they use for some of the data visualization. So it's the same analysis tools have been there, but a downstream visualization tool. It's a little different for analysis. But the same cell tracking software was used as previous, as people have done for a while. What she showed is that if you inhibit this linkage, this coupling, you have less NK cell generation. And what she showed, what happens is that this is an adhesion, right? And so if you're migrating down a line, you're getting exposed to different chemicals. And you need to pause and stay at one spot and be exposed to certain chemicals in order to become a mature NK cell. And if you block adhesion, that doesn't happen. So you need to pause and take a minute and smell the roses to grow up.
Oh, how poetic.
Aww. All right. And then there was like 6 or 7 talks, but one of the other ones that really stuck with me was Uma Kanthedi from the University of Colorado. Her title was Antibody Blockade of Cis-PD-L1 and CD8 Interactions on Dendritic Cells Dictate Chemokine-Driven Migration During Inflammation. All right. High level, we know PD-1 blockade. So we know dendritic cells migrate during inflammatory responses, and you know, that this is affected by PD-1. Right. So interesting, PD-1 inhibitors don't alter DC migration, but PD-L1 inhibition does. So, you know, but how does this be? It's PD-1, PD-L1. That's what binds. Well, no.
Oh, no. There is another ligand.
There is PD-L1 CD80 interactions as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've heard of that.
So that's what matters. And it's specifically a tyrosine 56 moiety because they used a bunch of PD-L1 antibodies and the ones that bound most tightly to tyrosine 56 based on structure function modeling, you know, the structure molecular docking, that matters most. So that was cool. And then lastly, Jian Yu of University of Iowa looked at the role of fat in psoriasis, and their title of their talk was FABP5 Promotes Saturated High-fat exacerbated psoriatic inflammation. So eating too much high-fat diet causes you to have worse psoriasis. This is something that's been described before. This work showed that saturated but not unsaturated high-fat diets made things worse in their mouse model of imiquimod-treated skin. And this is due to increased vulnerability to neutrophil infiltration. And they showed that this was through fatty acid binding protein 5. So if you knock out FABP5, you have less psoriasis, and this is all mediated by an IL-1, IL-17 level. So knock it out. High saturated fat diets no longer induce IL-1, IL-1.
It's complete beta, knockout?
You know, pan tissue knockout.
Okay.
So there you go. So those are the ones that I presented today.
All right. Thanks for sharing, Jason. So for my side, I attended the session on transplant immunology, ongoing interest of mine. And I thought it was very nice. First off was Karina Rodriguez Lima from Mass General Hospital, the transplantation unit. And her talk was titled Cyclic E is a novel co-inhibitory receptor in the modulation of innate activation after transplantation. And basically that's kind of, the title tells a lot of it. So she looked at this molecule, sialic acid binding immunoglobulin-like lectin, so Singlec. And there are several different versions of this molecule, but she focused on Singlec E. So she looked into transplantation, and she saw that if you have a Singlec E knockout, you have a much increased rejection of a transplant. In this case, she was looking into kidney, if I remember correctly. And so the mechanism behind this was that the absence of Singlec E on dendritic cells resulted in an increase of the dendritic cell activation, basically. You have more expression of MHC, interferon gamma, costimulatory molecules. So in a way, this molecule was preventing the activation of dendritic cells and thus the activation of allogeneic T cells. And so she showed that this was mediated by NF-kappa beta activation on dendritic cells. And so they kind of reach out to a model in which the signaling of cyclic A is interfering with NF-kappa beta function, and that therefore this can help reduce the allogeneic activation of T cells by these dendritic cells. So I guess this has a very interesting, of course, very therapeutic possibility, maybe by increasing cyclic E signaling, or in a way it shows why this kind of this cyclic molecules, which are known from being for being modulating, immunomodulating, this is another way in which they are modulating the immune system in general. So after a 15-minute break, we have Michael Nicosia from the Lerner Research Institute at Cleveland Clinic. And he talked about LAG-3 and how it can regulate antibody responses following kidney transplantation. So he started off with antibody-mediated rejection of kidney and how that is, of course, a major source of rejection in general in transplantations, and particularly in kidney. So LAG-3, on the other hand, you have LAG-3, which is this well-known molecule, kind of active, very well established in T cells. It is expressed in several types of T cells, but not particularly, I would say, regulatory T cells. And the ligands of LAG-3 are various, but I think the most well-known is MHC class 2, also GAL-3. But it is not very well-known what is with LAG-3 in B cells. So in his research, he kind of looked into LAG-3 expression in a kidney and a rejection, kidney rejection model. And he shows that, in fact, LAG-3 is also expressed on B cells, but particularly on plasma B cells. And she shows that in those transplants that are stably tolerated, there's a clear detection of LAG-3 in slides and in the samples, both from human and mouse. So there seems to be also a correlation between LAG-3 expression and induction of tolerance. And this relates to what we see in LAG-3, for example, in cancer, in which LAG-3 is negatively related to cancer rejection. So I guess it kind of makes sense. So he has LAG-3 knockout mice, and what he shows is that these mice have a higher development of alloreactive responses. And this is already before transplantation. So they have already a baseline of alloreactive T cells that is higher than the normal mice. And they uniformly reject a graft, in this case a CH3 kidney to a LAG-6 mouse, and this looks and they has a lot of the hallmarks of an antibody mediated rejection. So he finds expression again in LAG-3 of in normal mice. LAG-3 is expressed not only on T follicular helpers but also on plasma cells and not in other types of B cells. So what they suggest is a correlation of LAG-3 expression can reduce the rejection, and it can affect both T cells and B cells. So it can act through expression on B cells and T cells and B cells. Next up, we had Ismail Sayin from the University of Chicago, and again talking about antibody reactions in after transplantation. But I think this was cool because he was talking about autoreactive B cells. So it makes sense that you think, well, B cells generated against the kidney graft or the transplanted tissue makes sense, all those other antigens that are specific to this tissue. But then what he pointed to, which I think we already knew, is that in fact there's not only antibodies against clearly foreign antigens from the transplant, but also you end up finding a considerable amount of autoreactive antibodies, you know, like autoantigens, nuclear antigens, things like that. And so he looks into to the generation of these two types of either donor-specific antibodies and autoantibodies in the context of acute rejection on kidney, and how, for example, although we have treatments such as CTLA-4 immunoglobulin, CTLA-4 has been very promising in reducing acute rejection in kidney transplants. And he showed that although it can prevent the development of donor-specific antibodies, it does not affect the development of autoantibodies in acute rejection. And this might have to do with the fact that he sees that the donor-specific antibody response is primarily generated, it's generated both in the spleen and in the allograft, whereas the self-autoreactive response seems to be almost exclusively developed within the allograft. So they have kind of completely different kinetics and places where these two responses are generated. And it's interesting because then, although CTLA immunoglobulin has been very promising for donor-specific antibody rejection, these autoantibodies can still generate despite this treatment. And he had a little bit of data about the pathogenicity of the antibodies, and he shows that indeed, for at least when it comes to complement activation, these antibodies can activate complement, which would suggest that they are, you know, true pathogenic antibodies. But I think it's very interesting because I don't think we think enough about what happens when, you know, you end up targeting your own cells because of the whole inflammation that is generated during the transplantation. And just for the end, I really liked the talk from Jessie Barra, the University of Florida, because she looked into a very, I think it was very cool, how to protect a transplanted cells with CAR T-regs when, so if you don't have, so you, a CAR needs a target, right? Something expressed on the surface in order to direct it against that. So he says, well, if we cannot find anything on these cells that we can, you know, target, why don't we add something to, you know, stem cells? And then if we have like cells derived from pluripotent stem cells, then they will all be expressing this antigen, and we can direct CAR T-regs against that antigen and then protect. So that's basically what he did. They introduced a truncated EGFR sequence into human pluripotent stem cells, and then a CAR on T-reg that recognized this EGFR. And then basically they show that you can, you know, generate the CARs. The T-reg are functional. They are regulatory. You can generate, you can differentiate, for example, beta cells from this human pluripotent stem cells that are expressing truncated EGFR. And then if you test that, if you put them in vitro and in vivo, you can see that actually these T-regs are protecting. So they get activated when they're co-cultured with this modified stem cells, and their resulting cells, like, for example, beta cells. And that actually they even do an in vivo engraftment of stem cell-derived beta cells. And they show that T-Rex can protect the graft under these circumstances. I thought it was very nice.
That's super cool for being able to have the T-regs do that. I guess the question is now, with all the CAR T cell risks that are being described, is the profile worth it? Like, obviously, if you have lethal cancer, having a risk of cancer in 20 years is, who cares, right?
That's true.
Lethal cancer now, cancer 20 years from now.
Maybe.
Right, maybe. Right, or very maybe. Like, but this is interesting.
Well, the question is that if you're going to die because you cannot protect your, if there's certain transplants that you need and you keep rejecting them.
Yeah. So yeah, if you have transplant rejection over and over and over and over and over again.
So, and then it was another talk about similar protecting cells by expressing, in this case, thrombomodulin and CD147, you know, this not, don't eat me signal on also islet cells. And I thought it was very nice for Mohammad Tariq from the University of Missouri. And basically they use this ProteX platform to display CD47 and thrombomodulin on the surface of islet cells, and that this could protect them from this particular type of rejection or particular type of problem for engraftment, which is instant blood-mediated inflammatory reaction. And so I think it's also very nice by kind of coating the cells with this, they protect and they maintain the integrity after exposure to blood, and also they seem to engraft better in an in vivo model. So transplantation, immunology, very interesting. A lot to do in there.
Yeah, well, seeing that some of those transplants is a powerful thing. All right, well, with that brings us to the end of our first Immunology 2024 episode. Don't forget to follow us on X at Immunol Podcast to find out what we're up to at the meeting, and visit us at the Immunology Podcast booth on the exhibitor floor where you can win a gift basket. Check back here tomorrow for another episode recapping day 2 of the meeting. See you then.